begin by thanking the organizers for the invitation. It's great to be here, Catherine in particular, and also for the honor of starting these proceedings off. Catherine asked for a survey on something. That's my favorite topic, so that's what I'm going to do. And I should begin by saying to the many experts here that there's nothing new from Indiana coming out of this talk, but that's not to say there aren't many new things. I'm going to try to highlight them as we go through. So at the bottom are my two long-term friends and collaborators. Walter is here. Pleased to put that up there. I didn't quite know what the audience is, so this will be not so technical. That's what I'd like to do, so I'll begin by writing down the various equations and their differing versions. And I'd like to try to show what kind of estimates you get for free and those you have to work for. Then a fair part will be the middle, where I try to describe what is known and what is not known. And the way you find out you fix things that are not working is to try to find some kind of smoothing mechanism. There are several of them known now. They're all the same, but there are several nonetheless. And then, as I go through, speaking of smoothing mechanisms, I'd like to highlight the recent results of those people up there. Is Professor Stoppelani here this morning? I don't know her. I guess not. Okay, none of those is here. Tomorrow? Okay. Francois Gloss is here. He's somewhere back there. There he is. So I'd like to have a few say a few words about interesting stuff he's done. And lastly, although it's not directly related to the Vlasov-Maxwell problem I'm going to talk about today, is new work of Yang Guo, who will be here Friday, I hear. Guo's work is remarkable for many reasons. Among them, it's a completely different method, totally different from anything. It handles five-dimensional null spaces of Boltzmann problems with ease and differently. And it applies to an amazing spectrum of problems which we couldn't touch before. These are small data results, so it's not quite what I am looking at today. Nevertheless, it's really good stuff, and it should be known. So let me get back to Vlasov-Maxwell. You see that? Okay. All right, so many of you in the audience know better than I, far better, what a plasma is. So we're going to assume that electromagnetic effects dominate collisions, ignore collisions, therefore. So Maxwell will be involved, and I've just written down in the middle of the page, a little below here, the Maxwell equations, which everyone knows. So C is currently the speed of light. It'll be set equal to 1 in a moment, as will all other parameters, masses and charges and everything else. The two things of interest you see there are the rho, called the charge density, as you see, and the current, which is J on the right side of the E evolution equation. And those are going to be chosen very specifically, but very, very naturally, in terms of the Vlasov density, which will come on the next page. So Maxwell is known to us very well. And before I leave that, let me put up here. You can't stuff arbitrary charge and current densities into Maxwell because the time-independent constraints won't necessarily hold. Let me throw this back up here for just a moment. As everyone knows here, there are two evolution equations, but then two time-independent constraints. So if you want to keep them going, the way to do it, at least for smooth solutions, I missed the slide. There's the slide. Here we go. There it is. Is to impose that continuity equation. So as is well known, whatever the charge and current densities are, rho and j, they will have to satisfy that. and then that'll at least formally take care of the time-independent constraints in Vlasov, which is about to appear. Okay, let me see. Here's a very brief page about the derivation of the Vlasov system. It's not really a derivation, but maybe it'll suffice to show how naturally it comes up. You have to give up following individual particles, of course, so you assume there is a distribution, little f on phase space. Phase space is the 6D collection of three-dimensional x, three-dimensional d. Time is the t argument. Each such species will have a distribution. There should be several, those of electrons, various types of ions. But for today, let's just keep one species here. So think of f. Each f would be a scalar. We have only one. And now if you denote by u the velocity in phase space, then the first step that everyone uses is just to write the Liouville equation down. There it is. So this is a well-known expression from continuum mechanics. And really, that's all there is to the Vlasov-Maxwell system. So, for the following reason. When you compute that divergence, you will get two terms, of course. One of which has the derivatives hitting f. On the other one, the derivatives hit the velocity, u. This is the velocity in phase space. Now, if you just write down the Newton equations in phase space, x dot is v, of course, and the derivative of v is the Lorentz force from electromagnetism. So that's a well-known expression of force equals mass times acceleration. Now, for that term where the derivatives hit u, u is the velocity, you see that the x derivative of the first right-hand side is identically zero. The v derivative of the second term, the Lorentz force, is also zero because v appears as a cross product. Therefore, one of two terms where the derivatives hit u is gone, and you're left simply, whoops, with that on the bottom. You see that? So it's as simple as can be looking first order partial differential equation. And the fields, the E and the B, the electric and magnetic fields, appear as coefficients of the V derivative. That just comes from that expression up there, that Liouville equation. That's all there is to it. So let me rewrite it again. Yes, please. Yes, indeed. That's coming soon. It sure does. It's a perplexing issue for us. So as a matter of fact, so there I've just rewritten each of the equations that has appeared before. The Vlasov equation up top and the Maxwell system in the next line. Now the only thing that needs to be specified is the rho and the j, the charge and the current densities. Now to do that, let me ask you to look at this nonlinear term for a moment, the fields times the v derivative. And it's a simple calculation to show that that last term, sorry, not so very easily visible, the last term, in fact, even though it looks like a product, can in fact be written as a perfect v derivative. It's a v divergence. So let's look up top here again. In this term here, I have an x derivative. Perfect. This term we just noticed was a perfect v derivative. And therefore, upon integration in v, it suggested that that's what rho and j should be. So rho is essentially the v integral of f. The minus n of x, let's forget about for a moment. These things should be neutralized, but let's forget it, please. And j is the first moment. So it's that simple. That is the system. And I guess there's the entire system right there. Once again, in general, there should be several F's. It's really a system of equations for F. But as you can see, it's completely natural. Unfortunately, its solution doesn't seem to be quite so natural, at least not for me. So let's see here. Write down some interesting parts. First of all, you've already seen it's non-local because of those integrals over v. V is velocity there. In the Vlasov equation, you have the last term is the fields times the v derivative. Therefore, it's quadratic. And v itself is, of course, in this case, in this setup, it is the velocity. And it's an independent variable, as we don't see in other problems. Because the Vlasov equation for F itself was a first-order PDE, when you write down its characteristics, which are the solutions of those two ODEs right in the middle there, and then compute the derivative of your density function F along a characteristic, you get, of course, zero. It's more or less exactly the same thing. And so one of the two things you get for free is a bound on the initial, on the distribution function F. If it is bounded initially, it stays so. If it's non-negative initially, which it should be because it's a density, then it stays so. So that's one of two things you get for free. The other thing you get for free is an energy estimate, which will be relevant in just a moment. And by the way, I should say, well, let me do it on the next slide. We just had a question a moment ago about the relativistic case, so let me try to address that now. If you look in every book that I know of on plasma physics, you will see the Vlasov-Maxwell system that we wrote up there a minute or two ago. And it has, at least it would seem to have a flaw. It has Maxwell, which is Lorentz invariant, coupled to that Vlasov equation, which is not. Nevertheless, that's the equation you see everywhere. So it must be the right equation, right? Well, I don't know. Causes immense difficulties. So one thing we do is to look at the relativistic version. Now remember, please, the speed of light is 1. So what I call v hat there, v is now momentum, therefore v hat is velocity. And as you can see, I guess I can write over here, as you can see, v hat is absolutely less than 1. But it, that's okay, thank you. But it can get close to 1, as you see, for very, very large Vs. Now what you do is replace in all three places every appearance of V by V hat. So the first place it appeared was in the x partial derivative coefficient, right there. The next place it appeared was in the Lorentz force, right there. And in just a moment, last place is right here in J. So you see the hat on the V there. Those are the three changes. That's it. So let me put this back up here and ask now, do you really need the relativistic case? And that's a question I can't answer. Well, I've been working like crazy on it and I still can't answer it. From a mathematical point of view, the answer seems to be yes, because each of the methods that's known to treat existence for this system requires speed less than 1. Now, speed less than 1 really means speed less than the Maxwell speed. All right, Maxwell propagates at the speed of light, of course, which is now taken to be 1. This thing is going to propagate at speed v hat. So as you see, there's trouble when V becomes huge. because then V hat will approach 1 in length, and the characteristics will get close to each other. Nevertheless, there are things we can do here which we cannot do for the classical version. So the long-winded answer to yes is very important. And I'll try to say a little bit more about it as we go. Okay, so that's the relativistic version. And here's a couple of things on the top. Is again just the definition of the sources, rho and j. As you can see, rho did not change. It's just j has a hat on it. That's it. Okay, now number one here, as we've seen, large momenta will cause the speeds to approach 1, and then we could be in big trouble. Now, these small data theorems that are known today keep control of V. If you can control V, then the speeds are controlled. That is, they're never close to 1, and you're in pretty good shape. There's one other issue here which is confusing to us, to me, I should say. I mentioned before there were two things you get for free. One is the estimate on the non-negativity and boundedness of the plasma density, little f, and the other is a statement of energy conservation. So in the classical case, the kinetic energy has that appearance right here, as we all know. That's just 1/2 mass velocity squared. But when you go to the relativistic case, so that our methods will apply, you pay a price, and the price is that the energy integral appearing on the bottom there has only 1 moment. Now, that's a serious issue. That comes back to haunt you and causes us immense grief. But at least we can get off the ground with a relativistic setup. In the classical setup, I can't even start. Okay, so let's see, I did that already. And the other equation I'd like to write up here, a simpler version. The one first studied and greatly studied all over the place is the Poisson version, where you more or less cross out B, just make the magnetic field go away. Think of that as being obtained from passing to the limit C going to infinity. In fact, that problem has been done by many people, but including Pierre Degon and Jack Schaefer, showed that the Vlasov-Maxwell solution will go to the Poisson version. And as you see, Maxwell then has been replaced in all its grossness. It's been replaced by a single elliptic Poisson equation. This guy right there. So you solve the Poisson equation, Laplace and U equals rho. Take its gradient, that's the electric field, put it into the equation, and go to town. Hope it works. It does work, as we'll see very soon. But this is, despite its simpler looking appearance, it's a formidable problem on its own. Okay. This one here? Okay. Ah, okay. So, I'm coming to them soon, but essentially you say that each of the initial data functions has to be very small, less than some constant, depending on other parameters in the problem. If it is suitably small, then we can show it extends for all time. It's coming at this moment. Is that okay? Okay. So let me see. Here's the problem I want to solve. And I can't. So I want to start the relativistic version with Cauchy data, so values for the phase-based density, little f, values for the fields. And they can be as smooth as you want. Smoothness is not an issue. I don't care how smooth they are. But what I don't want to do is make a restriction on their size. So I'm going to just pick them, let it roll, and does the solution then exist smoothly for all time or not? Still, that's one of two great open problems. There's another one coming up soon, too. So this is known in several cases. It's not known in the case I want. And so let's look at just what is known and is not. Okay, so let me start with that slide right there, because it was from Jürgen Bott, professor at Munich, that I first heard the word Vlasov uttered in 1975. So he had worked on it for a long time. I think even in his thesis, partly was that, wasn't it? Terrible thesis problem, boy. Anyway, in 75, he looked at the Poisson inversion, no magnetic field. He took initial data that was large, but it had to be spherically symmetric. Sorry. And then he showed, analyzing the characteristic of the E's, that you get a smooth global solution. So as far as I know, that was the first global result for the nonlinear system, I think. That same year, a proof of weak solutions was published too by Arsenyev. So it's, I think that's about the beginning. So some 6 years later, Bott had a student named Horst who did the same problem but for cylindrical data. That was a big change. That's a big change. Okay, then let's see, Jack Schaefer and I looked at the relativistic version a few years later. It's probably not a good equation because it's not the limit of Vlasov-Maxwell for large C's. But here, at least in the relativistic case, you have to watch your choice of sign. If you mess the sign up, you'll certainly get bad behavior. And most relevant for the talk today is this paper from 86, which I did with Walter here. And basically, it gave us local existence to the Cauchy problem for Vlasov-Maxwell, and further provided a criterion under which we'd know if you could extend the solution smoothly to all time. And it is this paper, 86, which has been generalized twice now in the last 2 years by the people I mentioned, Staffilani and Kleinemann, and Bouchou and François Gauss, and we'll, I'd like to talk about that more as we go on. So here is the just a statement of, no, sorry. Well, Y1 is on the bottom. We knew how to do small data for a long time. It's where everything is small. Each of the densities of the plasma in each of the fields is a generalization the next year or so, where we still really needed to require that the fields be small, but the individual densities themselves could be large, provided they almost canceled. So let me ask you to think of it this way. If you have a density of, say, ions and a density of electrons, then this result here said that these two densities can be any size you want as long as that difference was small. So that's one of the statements of small data. Does that make sense to you? Okay. But I need the field small too. So in that sense, the small data problem was done. And then the end of the 80s came the amazing velocity averaging smoothness results. And the following year, or so, DiPerna and Lyons were able to get the existence of global weak solutions through many equations, as you see, as we all know, I think, And by the way, let me point out that in this treatment, it doesn't matter whether the equation is relativistic or classical. It matters not at all. The method doesn't see it. Yet, certainly for the classical formulation, the difference is drastic, and we can't control it. But not in the weak formulation. Then I mentioned this gentleman, another student of Bott, who actually wrote the first proof of large data global existence for the Poisson version. It was a tough proof to read, really tough. And it was immediately followed, in fact, maybe even simultaneously, by three others. Schaefer basically took Pfaffelmoser apart and fixed him up in a readable manner. Nolens and Petam had a completely different proof. Completely nice proof. It, however, does not apply to the Maxwell case either, regrettably. And then Horst did another simplification. So those are some major results. Then I guess I can say down here at the bottom, with Schaefer, I was able to do the two-dimensional problem, large data. And further, as you see, there's something called, as I think everybody knows, there's something called a two and one-half dimensional problem, which means you have two x variables, two space, and three velocity. So that is known. But the step from two to three seems to be a painful one. A couple of years ago, we looked at the Poisson version, the relativistic case with cylindrical symmetry, but no size restriction. And we were almost able to do it. There's a weakness in that theorem that I didn't write there, which is that you have to make an assumption about the initial data that its momentum support does not include the origin. It's probably a function of the method. Nevertheless, as far as I know, it's the only 3D result of its kind. Okay, and then let's look at the very last one here in the last two or three years. That 86 paper of did with Walter, which I mentioned, has been extended twice. First, I think Kleinemann Staffelani, who exploited the linearity of the Maxwell equations in the sources. Now, that dependence, it's not smooth, but it is linear. So they were able to use Fourier transform. And now here, Francois and Bolchu have a completely different proof, which has a number of advantages, a couple of which I'd like to try to point out as we go along here. And then I already mentioned Guo's amazing new research, but I want to point out here that he can also do, for the first time, Vlasov-Maxwell plus a collision term, a real collision term, near equilibrium. That had never been done before. There had been local theorems given, a lot of other work, but with the full Maxwell and a true collision operator, this is the first. So I don't know what he's talking about Friday, but maybe that's it. Okay. So that's a very quick summary of some things that are known. I know very well. Didn't include everything. So let's talk a few minutes about, what's the time? When did I start? I didn't notice. Okay. Thanks. Okay, so if you want to solve this problem, the Vlasov-Maxwell problem, start with an iteration, and here's a perfectly natural one. You take a guess or use the initial value as your starting F. Compute the sources on the next line, the row and the J. Push them into Maxwell. Solve Maxwell. Get a new field. Stuff that into Vlasov, get a new F, away you go. Very, very natural thing. Unfortunately, it fails. And rather than spend a lot of time on why it fails, let me put it this way. Let's convert the fields into wave equations. It's because I'm generally more comfortable with them, as there are many of us. As you see, on the right side of the equations for E and B, you have derivatives of the sources, of course. Now, if you just have the Poisson version, then you can handle derivatives. You can integrate by parts and remove the derivative. But because it's Maxwell or hyperbolic, once you have a derivative over there on the right side, it's there to stay, unfortunately. That's another way to say just that. That, you know, you can't invert the wave operator on these nice CK spaces and get away with it without losing a derivative. So that's what loss of derivatives is. So let's see how we might go about doing this. Here's the major theorem, which is now, as I said before, has been reproved a few times by different methods. And it says, again, relativistic case. We cannot do this for the classical version. Just can't do it. It says you try to keep the momentum in a fixed ball whose radius doesn't get too big. Well, let me see. I can put it right here, put the definition. Here's the definition of V hat. And now you see that if V is confined to some ball, then V hat stays strictly away from one. Right? That means the characteristics never get close to each other. And so it might make sense that that's the theorem. So the entire process of existence and regularity is then reduced to this a priori bound. And it's this theorem now, which has been generalized twice, as I pointed out before. So all you have to do, in a sense, is keep that momentum under control. But that turns out to be, at least in my experience, a truly formidable problem, one which I can't do in general. So let me, to continue, let me go back and write down again right there how we're going to try to handle this. So you write down a wave equation for E, and on the right side you see, of course, derivatives. So what do? Just write a formula, invert the wave equation, and you'll have then the inverse of the wave operator integrated against stuff like that. Obvious thing to do, when in doubt, integrate by parts, of course. But it doesn't work, and here I think I can show you why. Let me get down to the bottom of this thing here for a moment. There were two terms on the right side of that E equation a minute ago. One involved the derivative of rho, space derivative, which I've written there. The other involved a current derivative, which I'm just going to forget about for a moment. So what I'd like you to see here is, first, this integral over the ball radius x, center x radius t, with respect to that, evaluated at this time slot. That's just the inverse of the wave equation. And the v integral you see there is just the spatial derivative of the density rho, because the density rho was just the integral of f dv. So all I did there was write down what rho is and write it in the form of the inverse of the wave operator. So now you say, okay, just integrate by parts. Well, this derivative here means evaluate the spatial derivative at that y slot, the spatial slot. As you see, if you integrate by parts, the derivative will be transformed to the time argument. So you'd be swapping one derivative for another, hopeless, worthless, just doesn't work. So So the way we eventually saw through this, this is old stuff, but it's maybe not so bad for the audience, is to use four different derivatives instead of the time and three x derivatives. I use other derivatives. The t's are called tangential derivatives. You'll see in just a moment why they're nice, although they don't maybe look quite so nice. Omega will be that unit vector, and s is, as you, I hope, recognize, the Vlasov operator. It's just the operator of the first two terms of the Vlasov equation. So I have three t's and one s, four in all. And what we do now is just write a formula, and you can express the original derivatives in terms of the new ones by an ugly formula. Let's not worry about the formula. Let me just ask you to note two things. Each derivative, each original derivative, is a linear combination of the new ones, the s and the t. That's all I want you to see. And the denominators have those screwy expressions in them. So in the denominator, there's an expression like this. And that, I don't know if that's visible. Yes, please. When you invert the wave operator, you get an integral over a cone, a ball, all right, centered at x with that. Shoot. It's gone. Just a minute. I think I can answer that. Nope, that's not it. Here it is, right down at the bottom. The integral over this ball, dy over that, that's the distance to the vertex, as a function of some function evaluated at this time slot and that space slot. That's just the integral, that's the inverse of the wave operator. Okay? So what I did was apply it to rho. That's all I did there. The derivative of the rho, beg your pardon. Okay. Just an integration variable. All right, so I'm integrating over a ball centered x, radius t.
Right, so the y derivative, that's start off with an x.
Right, but it means the y derivative of this f evaluated at those slots. That's what it means. Okay, because that's what was on the right-hand side. All right, so yeah, it's an x derivative, but y is playing the role. Why the integration variable is the spatial integration variable. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. Let's see. So where was I? Here we go. Here's what we were doing. So again, using these new derivatives, then you can express the old in terms of the new, in, beg your pardon, the new in terms of the old, linear combinations of each with singular denominators. Okay, that's the whole point. Now, why would you want to use these two things? Because whenever you have a t term, the t is an exact derivative along the surface of a light cone. So whenever I see tf's, I can integrate by parts in the space variable. Now, what about the s terms? Well, the Vlasov equation itself is that right there. So sf, which was the usual transport operator, is equal to minus the nonlinear term, and we saw earlier the nonlinear term can be written as a perfect v divergence. Therefore, here's what you do. You write wave equation for E. On the right side, you will have derivatives of the sources, as we saw. You then replace those derivatives by linear combinations of S and T, and I can integrate by parts both of them out. The T's in the space variable, the S's in the V variable, and what we get then is that, a derivative-free representation, albeit pretty ugly, of the fields in terms of the densities given through singular integrals. And now I think maybe I can show, just very, very briefly, if you have an expression like this in the denominator, then of course it could be very singular. However, omega is a unit vector, and we saw a moment or two ago that if you can control v, then you can control v hat away from 1. So the assumption of the theorem was up here a minute ago, that the velocity or the momenta sit in a ball of radius t means you can control v. Then you can control v hat, keep v hat strictly away from 1, therefore these denominators don't bother us, away you go. That's basically how the proof works, except for the horrendous complication of estimating the derivatives, which is something we don't want to talk about today. Okay. Now at this point, I'd like to mention something about the relativistic versus classical case. That might be what a typical integral looks like. And as I just tried to say a few moments ago, if v is controlled, then v hat in length stays away from 1. Because omega is a unit vector, the denominator can be bounded below, say by something away, something strictly positive. So integrals like that, while we can't evaluate them, can be handled with an assumption. All right, now let me go back to your original question about classical version. This representation works, and if you want to return to the classical version, you just take the hat off of the V, like that. It's as simple as that. Now, some of the derivatives change, of course. But now, if you have that expression in the denominator, then you can see that it's going to be singular all over the place, not just for large Vs, but even moderate Vs could give you a singularity. And that's why we cannot touch smoothly the smooth classical Cauchy problem. We can only do the relativistic Cauchy problem. Because of the appearance of integrals like that, and you just can't bound V. Bounding V is the name of the game here. It's extremely difficult, it seems, in general. And therefore, we don't know how to do the classical case. And now let me point something else out. The simplest of all possible Maxwell versions is called 1.5 dimensional, which means there is 1 x variable and 2 velocity, or 2 momentum, if you wish. That's the lowest dimensional case where there is a non-trivial magnetic field. Even that problem in the classical setting cannot be done. We don't know how to do it. There are some interesting aspects to it. You can show easily that an a priori bound exists. That is, that the momenta, if you wish, sit inside some fixed ball. It's not a problem. What you cannot do is show that the fields are regular. There were characteristic ODEs up there a little while ago with the fields on the right-hand side. So if you want to make sense out of those ODEs, the fields better be Lipschitz, right, to make smooth sense out of them. We can show that these fields in this case are Holder exponent 1/2, but we cannot get close to 1. Not even close, not even in the ballpark. So I don't know what's going on here. Many of us have varying opinions that the characteristics will indeed cross, so something has to go wrong. There should be some singularity. I can't find a singularity. I've tried and tried. It may be on a very low dimensional set that you can't see with crude methods like this. You need to do something on a much finer scale. Okay, so now let me continue briefly with the two-dimensional problem, how that was done. You do the same thing. You write a wave equation for E. Sorry. pretty bad, isn't it? Here. A little better. Okay. And then you invert it. On the right side, of course, again, you get derivatives of the sources, the rho and the j, just as we had a few minutes ago. You always do. But now, because the inverse of the 2D problem is over a full ball, you might think, oh, well, now it should be easier to integrate by parts. So you try, you think about integrating by parts there, and the catch is that singular term, that square root in the first expression there, cannot be differentiated and come back with an integrable function. So you can think about integrating by parts, but it doesn't work, because the result, the integrated term is not integrable. So therefore, integration by parts doesn't work, as is no surprise. And even though it took us 10 years or so to do this problem, and just write down actually how we got away with it. So in two dimensions, the field structure simplifies a great deal, but it's not necessarily good news for the rest of the problem. The integration, as we saw, was over, now this time, a ball, solid ball, radius x, same, radius t, center x. So what we finally learned was, if you let c be that variable, y minus x over t minus tau, so it is strictly less than, c less than 1 describes the set of integration, then here are the two versions of s and t that work. Now, s is the same. But what we didn't see for years was how to get t. Now, if you look at t, the numerator of t is very much like we had a few minutes ago in the 3D case, almost the same thing. But you have an ugly-looking denominator there. So in the 3D case, t was a perfect derivative. This t does not look like a perfect derivative. But as a matter of fact, you can show it is. It's a space-time derivative of another unpleasant expression, but at least it is a derivative. So you're then encouraged to take a deep breath, integrate by parts, and write down the 10,000 terms that are about to appear. That's an exaggeration, but there are a few too many. So once again, what do? You take the derivatives that are that Maxwell gives you on the right side of the wave equation. You invert the wave operator. Every time you have an x or t derivative, you replace it either with these guys, t's, or with the s's, as the case may be. Integrate by parts, you get a horrific expression. But at the end of the day, or at the end of many years, I should say, it works. So here's why it's a little better. An integral that had this in the denominator a few minutes ago in the 3D case, where omega was a unit vector, that is now replaced in these calculations by this vector, xi. Xi is now less than 1, strictly, on a big set. So these integrals are non-singular on a much bigger set. Therefore, you're encouraged to try it. It took us years to get up the guts to do it, but that's sort of why it works. So in 2D, you have these two theorems. The first one says the same as in three dimensions, that is, if you can control the momentum support, then a smooth global solution exists. That's the same as the 3D case. And then secondly, we actually made an a priori estimate in 2D and showed that such a bound does indeed exist. Now, while I've got this theorem, first theorem up here, that one right there, let me go back to Francois's new paper and say something about this. It really almost killed Schaefer and me doing this problem. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever recovered from it. It's too much work. But it did not follow from the 3D case, despite all the things that were known. That is to say, the 2D case required a completely separate new argument. Well, in Francois's new paper, his method works also for 2D, so that struck a resonant chord with me. Where are you? Here you are. You don't have to do that extra argument. So that's a big advance. That's nice. And now I guess I should be wrapping it up. So maybe just a word or two about weak solutions. There's a setup like this, where you have a transport equation for F, and on the right side you have a derivative of something. So G, and that something, is the Lorentz force. And now the averaging lemma is quite amazing, saying suppose both F and G are L2 functions, and you multiply by a test function, say psi, some kind of appropriate decay, and integrate over velocities. And that expression is smooth in x and t. And that's the name of the game. That makes it all work for the following reason. This has been generalized, of course, tremendously now, but nevertheless, the original version works perfectly for Vlasov-Maxwell. Our nonlinear term, as we've seen before, is a divergence. So upon multiplying by a test function for the weak formulation, I can integrate by parts, put the derivative over on the other side. It suffices to take the test function, that's a product, as we know, space-time with a functional velocity. And now, when you write down the nonlinear term, after having multiplied by a test function and integrate by parts, you get that kind of expression. In other words, the expression you get is an integral of a product. One of two terms is the field E and or B, as the case may be. And the other term is not just the Vlasov density, but as you see, it's the integrated Vlasov density against a test function. From the energy integral, we know that E is bounded in L2. So we can take a weak limit. Before the averaging level, no one could solve this problem. But now that that last expression, the integral of psi against F there over V's, is in that Sobolev space with some positive exponent, it's compact there. Therefore, the product converges strongly. That's how you pass to the limit and get a weak solution. I know it's fast and not very detailed, but and I hope I've highlighted as many of the major results as I could. I see it's 10:30, so I think I'll quit. Thank you very much.